Welcome to the Hot Stove Society Radio Show. I'm Tom Douglas here at the Hot Stove Cooking School, virtual, right here in downtown Seattle, 4th and Virginia, upstairs of the Andra Hotel, floor number 2. We miss you terribly. We loved having you here in our audience, and until this virus passes, we're just going to have to do everything online. My buddy Terry is still out for now, hoping he's going to be back next week, and we are going to make do without him today. We have so much happening. Madeline, our producer, had her last show last week. I'd like to welcome Amy Richardson onto the mic. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
What's going on over there in the producer chair?
Well, I really miss my friend Madeline, but We have a great show, a really adorable cookbook that I'm excited to talk about.
All right. And tell us a little bit about you and why you like producing the show. And I know you're kind of just doing it temporarily until we hire out Madeline's position, but you're perfectly capable of doing this.
Well, thank you. I've been here working for the company for 15 years, spent a lot of time at Hot Stove. I'm definitely a home cook, not a professional cook by any means, so I'm excited to learn more and talk to you and just absorb.
What's the big thing difference between a home cook and a professional cook? If somebody were to say that to me, I would say just confidence generally, right? Yeah. You just attack the food like you would any problem.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you got carrots to cut or, you know, a pot roast to make or whatever, you just attack the food in a really different kind of confidence way. Whereas I think for me, the home cook is a little bit tentative all the time.
Yeah.
Maybe they haven't made it but 3 or 4 times. You know, I've made the same dish sometimes 100 times in a night.
Yeah.
Depending on how popular, like crab cakes, right? You know, so depending on how popular they are. But what is it to you? When you look at professional cooks, you're around restaurants all the time.
Yeah.
What do you see as the big difference?
Well, for me, I think the big difference is I don't know how to maybe skip some ingredients or what to replace it with or how to save time. But from advice from you, really reading the recipe and doing it, complete the recipe entirely.
Mm-hmm.
At least one time, and then you can kind of improvise. That's definitely what I have learned from you, and it does help. Because I get lazy sometimes and want to kind of do something
it's
else.
It's hard to follow a recipe. You're, you know, listening to music, you're watching TV, whatever it is while you're cooking, and it's definitely, you can miss a few steps. I think the biggest one is to read the recipe and get all the ingredients you need.
Yeah.
So many people don't even do that. We're going to tackle leftovers and how to kind of plan them. When you're making a big meal, like, for example, I'm going to talk about ossobuco today. We made ossobuco with risotto milanese for dinner 2 nights ago. And down at the beach, I haven't been to the Washington coast in 39 years. Isn't that crazy?
Wow.
And so I went down to the beach for a day or two, and we made ossobuco at our cabin. Yeah. So it was really nice. So I would talk about how to plan your leftovers even while you're buying the ossobuco. Right? I think that's really kind of an interesting play there. We're going to have cookbook author Aliyah Akam is here with her new book, Behind the Bar, which shines the light on 50 signature cocktails from different hotel bars around the world. And I'm right up her alley on this one. Yeah. I love a good hotel bar.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you ever been to Venice and Harry's Bar or any of these kind of classic in Paris, the Ritz or in London, Brown's Hotel or... Have you ever been to those?
I have not. But, you know, reading her book, most of it, I read most of it last night. It really is the perfect time because we're all missing travel. I'm missing a hotel bar, and I didn't even know that. But it really takes you there. She takes the time to talk about the hotel bar magic and the bartender's banter. And
well, you read the book, so is there any, like, Howard Johnson's or Travel Lodge in there?
No. There is not.
The Motel 6 bar?
Yeah, no.
Embassy Suites?
She does talk about, you know, she kind of loves a dive bar just as much as anyone else with the locals and hearing regulars come in and ordering the same drink and having that magic as well. But this book really ascends you to these destinations.
Right. My best dive bar in a hotel is the Hotel Mallory in Portland.
Oh.
And they had a great, and maybe still do. I haven't stayed there in years, but that was a great dive bar right in the... Across, I think it's 30 that cuts through kind of Portland the freeway. And anyway, it's right there, and it's a beautiful. They got the rooms are old-fashioned in the way that they're the size of my house.
Yeah.
You know, they're so big, like the Hotel Sylvia up in Vancouver.
Oh, nice.
But the Mallory has a great dive bar. Are you in need of some in-home saucier work? my friend Terry would be the perfect guy for this, but since he's not here today, I'm going to take on that role, and we're going to just talk about to rue or not to rue. Whatever you do, don't rue the day. Listen to our show. Get that? You got that? That was good. Yeah. How to do a productive pantry purge. I kind of mixed that yesterday with my reheating and my leftovers and, you know, using up what I have in the kitchen. And our very own Maggie Early is going to be here today. Maggie's been with us for years and is quite the cocktail maven. She's got Maggie's Hooch Hut out there at the warehouse bar.
She does.
And it's been fun to watch her batch cocktails and put them in little plastic containers to sell off the dock.
And taste them.
So she's going to be here talking about making mocktails, something without alcohol, maybe for the new year. And then for my taste of the week, this is always hard because I don't like tooting our own horn too much. I like thinking about, you know, but we don't get out as much as we did, you know, to go out and have a taste someplace else. And I've already talked about Thai Siam and the Pad Sayu and the salmon in the Red Sea and those things being my favorite takeouts right now. But we just added, for the first time in 15 years, a menu item at Sirius Pie, and it's only at the warehouse dock right now. But we added the Cuoco lasagna.
Man.
And I haven't had it in probably 2 years. And Cuoco's been closed now for about 9 months. So we added the Cuoco lasagna. And I forget how freaky good that is.
Yeah, it is insane.
It's freaky good. And it's seven layers, fresh pasta. But what's, it's got like a bechamel bolognese in between each layer. And it doesn't vary. All layers are the same thing. And then you put this nice bright tomato sauce underneath the slice after it's been roasted in the convection oven, so it's got a little bit of crust around the edge. It's like eating lasagna pudding.
Yeah.
It is so good. And I had a piece for lunch during the Christmas rush, and I was just shoved it down as fast as I could. I was making cheesesteaks, I think.
Yeah, I saw you eating it.
Oh, my God, I ate it so fast. But it was dynamite.
Yeah.
It was really dynamite, and I'm excited to get it back on the menu. The hardest part is getting it out hot because it's so dense that it takes time to reheat.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we're only having it at the one pie. We're working on the delivery. We can't sell too many or we'll get our whole system messed up. So we got lots to do today. Big show. We miss our pal Terry. Hopefully he'll be back next week. But in the meantime, we're going to carry on. Keep calm and carry on. Up next, it's time for Love, the Love of Leftovers on Cairo Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society Radio Show. Tom Douglas here. Terry's got the day off. Amy Richardson's joining us in the producer's chair. And Sean is on the audio video. Something that we always like to talk about here on the show is leftovers, especially in the holiday season when you're making larger feasts and maybe taking a little more time to cook a big dinner of renowned, you know, maybe your specialty, whether it's a big prime rib roast or it's just a simple, there's that dish that Brock made. You were just talking about something table with all the crudités and a big bowl of aioli. And that, to me, is a New Year's resolution right there waiting to happen. You have to look that up for me. Because I think I would love to show people what that looks like on our Facebook page. I'm Tom Douglas, by the way. And we went down to a place called Stepford.
Seabrook. So, see what you did there.
It's like this little planned community on the ocean, and I haven't been to the ocean in a long time. The Washington coast. I often go to the Oregon coast down there in the southern Oregon at a place called Bandon Dunes to play golf, but I haven't been to the Washington coast in 39 years. Jackie and I went there on a date one time. We rented a little place. And the place was like, you know, it's like some of those places that you rent where you have to clean after you go.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was cleaning after, this is 39 years ago, as we were cleaning after we went, the fan belt or the drive belt on the vacuum cleaner melted.
Ooh.
And left a black streak on the carpet. So we couldn't clean anymore. And so we get home and we get a call from the owner of the house wanting to charge us $700 to replace the carpet in there, you know, that we had ruined. And I said, lady, it's your vacuum broke. You know, it literally melted the drive belt, and that's what happened. That's why we stopped cleaning on that floors. And so she threatened to take us to court and all this kind of stuff. And I've always had a bad taste in my mouth for the coast. Yeah. I don't know what it is, but and I've always wanted to go back because my friend Fritzy Cohen owns the Moby Dick out there, and I've never been there to stay for a night. And anyway, we did it. We went back 39 years later, stayed at a place. I call it Stepford because it's – have you ever seen the movie Stepford Wives?
Absolutely. Nicole Kidman.
It's a classic. But anyway, it kind of felt that way. Mm-hmm. You know, like these planned communities sometimes give me the creeps. It's like going to a neighborhood that's built around U Village or something.
Yeah.
Or I don't know. Even U Village is a little bit more, you know, has a little bit more variance than this neighborhood felt very strict. Anyway, we stayed at Seabrook Cottages out on the coast, near Moclips, and really nice time. I was there for a day. It happened to be Monday this last week when it was so beautiful and sunny, and we had the full moon, so the high tide was up and down, and it was just a perfect day out there at the beach. We had, as we always do, plan our meals. We took coffee, we took our knives, we took our martini glasses, because nobody ever has the right kind of equipment. We took beautiful wines, and then in the house next to us was Madeline, our producer. Yeah. Madeline was, and her family was in the house next to us. And so we just had a good time, but we all ate separate, and we just talked from our porches. There's a good COVID separation. You know, about a 15-foot porch separation.
Mm-hmm.
You know the best part about that is? She has two little rugrats, and they can't come over.
Yeah.
I mean, she's just desperate to send the kids over to torture me, and she can't.
Yeah.
And her sister with
fingers. And
I know her sister was there with her two kids, and we just watched the kids from 15 feet away from the opposite porch. It was super awesome.
That is your dream.
I don't know. I'm going to be a grandparent soon, and it's I don't know. Can I do that to my own grandkid? Do you think? Can we just buy a house?
There's COVID.
Yeah, we have to keep COVID around for that. I guess maybe let's not do that. I'll suffer. Anyway, I'm not as mean as I sound. Anyway, so we made this dinner. We made ossobuco. Mm. So ossobuco is veal shank, and we bought them at that new butcher shop up on 80th and 24th in North Ballard, Crown Hill area, Loyal Heights, called Hearth and Cleaver. Mm-hmm. And they were the biggest ossobuco veal. And he says they were veal, but they were red like beef shanks. And Jackie browned them up. She did all the vegetables, the carrots, the celery, the onions, the shallots, the herbs. And we had brought our own chicken stock from our freezer. That's how we are.
Of course.
We used delicious white Chablis for the braise. And then made risotto milanese with it, with lots of saffron and beautiful Reggiano Parmesan Stravecchio. And it was just like the perfect beachside dinner with a big bottle, 3-liter bottle of Barolo for a couple of us.
It's very nice.
It's very nice.
Dinner.
Yeah. And it was fabulous. It was quite delicious. We had a pear tart from Le Panier for dessert. But getting back to the theme of this segment, which is leftovers.
Yeah.
Okay. So what do? These shanks were so big. We had tons of leftovers. We were coming home from the beach last night. What I decided to do was kind of combine two tricks that I like, which is I raid the pantry. I'm a good pantry raider. And so in my refrigerator pantry, I had a partial jar of piquillo peppers. I had a beautiful jar of cracked Castella Nuovo olives. I think that's how you say them, those green cracked Sicilian olives. I had anchovy paste. Butter, olive oil, and I had a half a bag of linguine, kind of spaghetti. And so I made a pasta, a separate pasta with garlic butter, all that stuff, like this spicy, lots of red chilies, a spicy little pasta, because ossobuco is heavy, right? It's got a heavy braise, it's thick, it's rich. I had already eaten the extra risotto cake, risotto in the morning, that morning before I left, as kind of risotto pancakes.
Yeah.
So good. I think the moral of my leftover story is I made this beautiful, spicy, fresh kind of refrigerator pasta with not a lot going on other than intense flavors of anchovy and garlic and chilies, blah, blah, blah. And then I reheated my ossobuco in that heavy richness and just put one spoon on top. I had cut up the meat into smaller bites and just put one spoon of this in the center of this bright pasta.
Beautiful.
And it was like an entirely different dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was exactly the same ossobuco from the night before.
Nice.
So that is key sometimes in using leftovers, because I know Jackie, my wife, is the worst leftover eater, because she doesn't want to eat the same meal twice.
Yeah.
I made this for her last night, and she loved it because it was like a whole new key.
That's meal. Nice.
Yeah.
I'm terrible at leftovers as well. If you are more of a home cook like myself, mm-hmm. Do you have any tips on how you would reheat your leftovers? Because mine feel like they just don't turn out as delicious if I'm
reheating.
Sometimes
they just feel like warmed whatever, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't feel special.
Yeah, like I made a perfect steak the other day, which I actually showed you
a
picture of.
Yes, you did. It was perfect.
Yes, but then when I reheated it the next day, it was terrible. So
it got well done?
Yes.
Yes.
So I don't know if there are any tips for someone like me.
Well, if you want to keep it rare, then I think the tip for me would be that you have to give it a quick sear, because all you want to do is kind of heat up the outside and keep the inside rare, right?
Yeah.
So for me, I would have taken that steak, sliced it up in the chunks, and then maybe made a stir fry out of it, where I could stir fry the steak, stir fry some carrots and mushrooms and things to go with it, have a little pot of ginger rice on the side.
Oh, yeah.
And now I've got a steak stir fry that's still got a little pink in the center because it's at that quick sear instead of roasting in the oven again.
That sounds so much better.
But does that help? Does that resonate?
It does. It does. Thank you.
Do you like cooking with a wok or in a hot pan? Because the key to that, not overcooking that meat, kind of not intuitively, is that the hotter the pan, the better off you are.
Sure.
Because what you're getting is that sear and quick heat on the outside and not overcooking the inside. If it's low and slow, you're going to overcook the beef again.
Yeah. I get impatient sometimes, so I need to remember that.
Yeah.
So. I also just heard from Chef Brock Johnson. He would make La Grande Aioli was the dish.
That's what it was. La Grande Aioli
for a
huge crudité board.
Uh-huh.
And then a big, beautiful kind of mason jar of aioli in the center.
Yes.
And then he likes to kind of run that for a few nights in a row, right?
He does. He does in Seabrook.
Oh, that's what he does
that's
in Seabrook.
What he
the
does.
Grande Aioli.
La Grande Aioli.
It's really, if you want a great New Year's repast,
mm-hmm.
I would say try La Grande Aioli.
Yeah, we'll post that on Facebook, too.
Okay, good. Up next, we have so much to do today. I can't keep up. It's Aaliyah Akam, Behind the Bars, her new book. We're going to talk to her next on Cairo Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Hey, welcome back. It's Tom Douglas here today. Sans Thierry Rotereau, the chef in the chapeau, is taking the day off. Amy is on the producer's mic, and Sean behind the AV. We do so many things here at the Hot Stove Society Show, but oftentimes life gets in the way. You know, we've all been through this COVID nonsense now for almost a year, and Terry and I have been running a segment on the show recently talking about when this thing ends, when we all get vaccines and we can travel again, where are we going to go and what cities? So we've been to Chicago, New Orleans, San Francisco, New York City. We've been traveling in our minds. And this new book came out by Aaliyah Akam, and it's called Behind the Bar, 50 Cocktail Recipes from the World's Most Iconic Hotels. And it fits right into that idea, which is, for me, I'm a world traveler, and I've been to many of the bars that she writes about in her book. But that's what I'm dreaming about right now. I'm dreaming about sitting at those bars, getting off an airplane after 20 hours of flying and sitting there and letting that bar bring me back to life. And that's what Aaliyah does in her book. So we'd like to welcome her to the show. Hi, Aaliyah.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. We are so thrilled with your book. Amy, you said last night you almost read it cover to cover.
I did. It made me just so happy how you described the settings and the best place to enter into the hotel bars. It was beautiful, and I love decoration and decor and design, so it was all of that. It was the bartender banter, the cocktails, and the atmosphere.
Right. Okay, Aaliyah.
It's the whole experience.
The whole experience. And it really is an experience. Even if you're not staying at that particular hotel, you can just go. Like, I very rarely stay at the Peninsula in New York, but I go to the King Cole Bar every time I'm there. So tell us about your book and your favorites and how you like to travel, Aaliyah.
Well, so I think it's interesting to start with, you know, originally this book, I submitted this book in December of 2019. And it was a celebration of the hotel bar in general. at that time to me, because to me, I don't know how you guys feel, but a hotel bar is just, it's so glamorous and transporting, perhaps more than any other genre of bar. And I wanted to celebrate that. It was a topic that hadn't really been covered in depth before. But then, of course, when this book came out this year, I think the meaning of the book changed completely, because suddenly we were no longer allowed to travel, and the book became a form of escapism. Mm-hmm. So the meaning really changed significantly. But I mean, my love of hotel bars was there at the very beginning, and I think my love of hotel bars has only deepened over the past year, because I can't go to any of them.
Exactly. And what's your background in general? Why would you be a traveler?
Well, so I've been writing about restaurants and bars and hotels and design for probably a little over 18 years now. So I'm very much plugged into this industry. I was a managing editor at a beverage trade publication for a few years, so I really got into the nitty-gritty of the cocktail and bar industry at that point. And I started to travel more, and as I traveled more, I found myself going to hotel bars, especially because I was often traveling by myself. And I think the hotel bar is wonderful. It's ideal for the solo traveler. It's less intimidating because everyone around you is a stranger and is there for a specific purpose, and they're all visiting. And I think there's something wonderful about that energy in a way that you can't get from the dive bar, where everyone is a local. You're feeding off this mysterious energy. And yeah, I also, during this time, I moved from the States to Budapest 5 years ago. And one of the places that I started to feel really comfortable with the city and get to know it was by hanging out at the bar at the Four Seasons here. Mm-hmm. And I think that really all these different elements came together and fed my interest in this book.
Well, there's no doubt that when you're traveling and you're in a hotel bar, you can pretty much, there's a few things that are guaranteed. One is they'll speak your language generally. That is, there's English all over the world in these hotels. And that's, I know that's a cop out in a funny way when you're traveling, but it's also a safety net. And that's the other thing I was going to say, is hotel bars generally are safer than a lot of bars when you're out walking by yourself on the street, because, you know, they have security, especially things like the Four Seasons. They have security, they have cameras, and it's just a great way to kind of, it's an alternative. I would say it's not the only way to see a city that's brand new to you, but it's an alternative way to get to be comfortable there.
Yeah, and it's also, these bars, many of them tend to be open all day. So let's say you have a flight that gets in at 3 p.m. and you want to get something to eat then and have a drink to just sort of refuel before you go out for a meeting. It's the perfect place to just sort of get your bearings and hang out. And a hotel bar, it's not weird if you bring out your laptop or you're on your phone, because so much of the hotel bar is associated with business travel. So I think, I don't know, it's my sort of energy. So that's why I've always been attracted to it. But of course, I love bars of all kinds. The hotel bar is just a little more special to me.
Okay, so tell us some of your favorites that you've found around the world. Maybe some that are like the Ritz in Paris. I don't know if that's one, but I've certainly been there a few times. But there's just so many.
Well, that's it. And the Ritz in Paris is definitely in there. And, you know, there are many bars that I put in there that are classics that people have likely heard of. So like the Savoy in London, for instance, or Raffles in Singapore. I think these are really well-known, iconic hotels. And I wanted there to be a level of familiarity, but I also wanted to introduce people to hotels that maybe they haven't heard of that have really great bars, or the bar is a great way to, you know, the bar is a great portal into understanding that hotel. So I really tried to mix it up a bit. One hotel that I keep missing is the Stafford in London, and it's a very understated, almost residential hotel, and they have a wonderful bar that's also called the American Bar, not to be confused with the American Bar at the Savoy Hotel. And I just think it's such a classy, historic place. I would have had my book party there in the fall. Uh-huh. Unfortunately, that'll be delayed now. But that's a bar that I keep coming back to, because to me, this embodies like that classic, elegant, really wonderful service that you associate with a hotel bar. You could spend hours there just, you know, by yourself, having a meeting. It's just so comfortable, but it's so dignified at the same time. Mm-hmm. So that's one that I keep missing and keep coming back to because it's so close. Another one is, I think because I spent so much time in New York, I keep coming back to Bemelman's Bar at the Carlisle. And I don't know if you saw the Sofia Coppola movie that came out recently on The Rocks, but there's a scene where it takes place in Bemelman's, and I just was sort of like jumping out off the sofa, like, I want to be in that room. It's so magical.
Isn't that funny?
But that's a place that intertwined with Upper East Side culture in New York for me. Just sort of this like revolving door of eccentric New Yorkers. And
you know, there's a bar, you know, just a few blocks away from there called Harry's, which I think is kind of the most overrated bar in New York.
Oh, yes. Okay. I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Bemelman's is great. And it's old school New Yorkers, but anyone that hasn't been there before loves it as well. And, you know, so those are two like really classy bars that I keep missing and keep coming back to. And, you know, as soon as we can travel again, I would like to prioritize those.
The hotel with the dive bar in it is always fascinating to me. I was telling our listeners earlier that there's an old hotel in Portland called the Mallory that has just a great dive bar in the hotel. Are there any of those on your list where you just go in and you're overwhelmed with kitsch and wonderment, but yet it feels real?
Well, yes. So actually that bar is in the book, but because the bar, the thing was, it was so hard to narrow this down because, you know, this is 50 around the world, and you could easily do 50 in New York or London alone. And, you know, it was really hard to pare down, and I was going for that specific mix of the classic and the expected with, you know, the more surprising, the modern and the grand. And I felt like there were so many great hotel bars that are in hotels that are not what you would consider traditionally luxurious. And so I decided one of the spreads or sidebars, whatever you want to call them, is devoted to sort of that affordable luxury aspect of, you know, the hotels are maybe not these five-star oases, but they have these incredible hotel bars. And that hotel bar in the former Mallory, I believe it's called the Deluxe now, that is definitely in there because it has that really wonderful, like, old Hollywood vibe in it, and the cocktails are great. There was one actually in Seattle that I really wanted to put in, and I just didn't have room for, and that was Oliver's at the Mayflower Park.
Mm-hmm. Free appetizers.
You know, there's just so... Yeah. So, you know, it's also Broken Shaker in Miami. I mean, and Chicago and Los Angeles and New York, they have several outposts. You know, that's a great hotel bar. You can't write a hotel bar book without including that. But the hotels that they're in are not what you would equate with luxury. So there was a way of trying to get a little creative and putting in, you know, wherever I could squeeze in something that I thought was appropriate, I tried to do that.
Awesome. You've given us a way to kind of dream and get out and travel the world. Aaliyah Akam, her new book is called Behind the Bar, 50 Cocktail Recipes from the World's Most Iconic Hotels. And thanks for letting us travel with you in our minds for a little bit as we read your book. It's going to be great fun when the time comes to kind of, it's a small enough book you can put it in your suitcase, travel and make notes and make it your list. Make it these 50 bars to your list to get to before you die of Aaliyah's book.
It's a great book, Aaliyah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. The publisher is Hardy Grant Books, and so if you can't find it, I'm sure it's out there all over the place. So enjoy it. I think it's a super fun book. Up next, we have What to Grill This Winter. Yes, we are keeping our charcoal grill out and about during the entire year. Don't be putting it away. It's time to grill wintertime. On Cairo Radio, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Here we are in the middle of winter. It's the Hot Stove Society Show, and we're going to talk about grilling. Outdoor grilling, that is. Why not? If you're a real griller, you'll grill all year long. There's just a couple of things to think about when you're doing this process. I'm Tom Douglas here at the Hot Stove Virtual, where we do our radio show every week. Amy, our producer, do you have a grill? You probably have a gas grill.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, I'm so sad about
it's
that.
Very small.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been to your apartment only on the outside.
Yeah.
It looks small. Is it? You're a condo.
It's two stories, so it feels a little larger, ceilings.
So outdoor grilling.
Yes.
And I don't mean to be, what's the word, dismissive of gas barbecues, because there's a lot of good gas barbecues out there. And there's a couple of new versions that are kind of interesting where they put, you can kind of have a little chute by the burner of the gas flame that's full of wood chips to create some of the smoke that you get off of a wood fire. And I kind of like that idea. I've seen commercials for a few of those. But I'm going to talk about a charcoal grill today. And I know my friend Chef Terry would love to be here for this segment because he loves charcoal grilling outdoors all year long. His favorite thing is a filleted or boned out leg of lamb that he puts an olive tapenade on. He puts it on his grill and roasts the whole thing. And if you've listened to this show for any length of time, you've heard him talk about that many, many times. He does the same thing with a whole fillet of salmon. Let's talk about grilling in the wintertime, some of the basic techniques. One, I think the number one thing, this is number one, whether it's winter, summer, spring, or fall, is that you have to be able to manage your fire, right? You have to be able to know what's going on in your kettle and not just guessing. And so the only way to really do that is if your kettle or grill doesn't have a thermometer, I just take a metal bit on my drill. I drill a tiny hole that fits the stem thermometer that goes up to 600 plus degrees, and I put that thermometer in the middle of my kettle so I know what's happening in there. I don't have to keep lifting the lid to know how hot my grill is. So if you don't have some sort of control, you're just flying by the seat of your pants, and that's no way to grill.
Sure.
If you can smoke that way, generally, but even then you'd like to know that your grill is at 250, 275, and it's steady, rather than kind of fluctuating up to 350 and then down to 225, you know, stuff like that. The biggest thing with grilling or slow barbecuing is managing your heat. So if you don't have that, get that started. Get on to Home Depot or Amazon or wherever and get yourself a nice thermometer for your grill. Secondly, you have to remember that when it's 40 degrees outside and you're baking a turkey in your grill, it really does affect what's happening inside. So if it's 90 degrees outside and you're doing a big roast like that, it's going to go about 30% faster than if it's 40 degrees outside. And sometimes if it's even freezing, it'll go 50% longer in the winter because your grill is metal and it's just constantly picking up the chill as well as the heat from the inside, but it's picking up the chill from the outside. So it's something to really be aware of when you're planning a dinner on the charcoal grill in the wintertime is that it takes longer.
Mm-hmm.
So now if you're searing steaks, you know, we're on an open grill and you just got to kick butt fire, then it doesn't matter. Then you're not really in that same situation. It maybe takes 10% longer just because of the ambient air. But for roasting, it does take a little longer. What else did I want to say about grilling? The indirect and direct. And I often work the heat line in my grill, especially if I'm, say, I have a brisket in my fridge right now. I found the prime brisket, and I couldn't pass it up. It's been sitting in my fridge for 4 weeks, but it's cryovac, so it's okay. I often work the heat line when I put my brisket on. So a brisket is probably a 10 to 12-hour slow 275-degree barbecue. And so I work the heat line. So I put all my charcoal on one side of the grill and way over. It's like it's only a quarter of the grill. That's my heat source. Then the brisket goes on the heat line, which is where the charcoal stops and the open part of the grill happens. And that is where I like to do slow roasting, whether it's a turkey, a brisket, a prime rib, or whatever. I don't ever really cook directly over the coals unless I'm searing a steak or something with caramel. You know, maybe I cook my ribs. Jackie loves her ribs caramelized with sauce afterwards. I like to slow smoke them, and then I like to dip it in the sauce. She likes it caramelized on, so that's when I move my ribs over. I put the sauce on, caramelize it over direct heat. So those are a couple of techniques and things to think about when you're winter grilling. Amy, what if you could right now, if you had a good barbecue,
yeah,
what would be the meat or fish that you would want on there?
Well, you know what I would want to do? Could you possibly do coal-roasted vegetables at the same time?
Mm-hmm.
This reading this segment really made me think of the Palace Kitchen and Cole Roasted Veggies. So could you have your, I know you're going to be mad at this, but the boneless, skinless chicken breast like Loretta likes.
What is that? I don't know what that is. Boneless, skinless chicken breast.
Yeah, it's delicious.
Yeah.
Could I be doing that at the same time?
Well, in the coals?
Yeah. So you have your Cole Roasted Veggies maybe on the bottom, and then could you be grilling meat on the top?
Well, I'm not sure what veggies you're cold roasting, but maybe that you don't quite know the technique. So a cold roasted veggie, like let's say you put a potato in foil and then you put it on the coals. That's one way to cold roast. And then you can do it kind of from scratch.
Yeah.
If I was saying, you know, we often make cold roasted sweet potatoes, but those are baked sweet potatoes that I finish in the coals and kind of burn and char the skin.
Okay.
And finish those in the coals and then serve it. And I like to eat that charred skin. When it comes to veggies like a carrot or a cucumber, those are fine in there. But basically, you're creating an ash on the outside, and you have to decide if that's pleasurable to you or not.
Yeah.
Like cold roasted leeks or that sort of thing. Eduardo one time from June Baby and what's the name of his first restaurant? Anyway, when he was down working with Matt Dillon down in Pioneer Square, he did cold roasted cucumbers. And I liked it. I liked it. It's not something I want a ton of, but I liked it.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't put broccoli in there or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's just not. I would roast those on the grill.
Mm-hmm.
In the fire, in a cast iron pan, over the direct heat, and then get my char and stuff, and you pick up smoke from the grill itself.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't put those right directly in the coals.
Okay.
Yeah. But coal roasting is very sexy.
It is.
Yeah,
it is.
It does. And it's good, too. I like it. And people sometimes send back there when I say this, when we put it on the menu, people say, my potato's burnt, because they don't even taste it. They just look at it, and they see that it's charred, you know, and they... And they send it back before they even try it. But try it. Give it a shot. It's a sweet potato. What's it cost you? 50 cents? A dollar?
Yeah.
It's fun to give it a shot. But bake it first and then put it in the coals and get a nice char on the skin. It gets really smoky and good and delicious and great with tons of butter.
Yum.
And you know what's really good on that? Goat butter.
Ooh, yeah.
Sometimes people forget to use goat butter. It's like goat cheese, right? It has a little bit of that goaty kind of wild flavor, and it's really a nice change when you're eating something with tons of butter. The other thing I wanted to say was things like squash. Cole roasts beautifully. So like butternut squash goes right on. You can either just put it, you know, like for example, I'm not going to eat the skin of the butternut squash personally. So then I can put that skin into the coals and kind of char it there. Eggplant, where you're charring the outside, but you're going to peel the skin off. Peppers.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people try to cook their peppers way above the coals. Just throw them right in the coals and char that skin.
Yeah.
And then pull them out. And then you're going to peel the skin off anyway. Why not?
Yeah.
Onions work beautifully. Things like apples and pears, the skin burns off because it's full of sugar. And so it doesn't work quite as well. So lots of fun things to do in the wintertime with your charcoal grill and managing your heat. That's the lesson learned today. Coming up in our second hour, we'll chat about sauces to make at home, to make use roux or not to roux. Plus, we have tips for your New Year's pantry purge. And Maggie is here, Maggie Early from our group, to talk about mocktails. Maybe you're taking a little January alcohol break. You need a little mocktail. On Cairo Radio, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show, hour number two. We've got another big hour for you. Chef Terry's got the day off. Hopefully he'll be back next week. Looking forward to that. I miss my buddy. In the next hour, we'll help you do a pantry purge for the new year. And I think there's some things that are just naturally around your house that you've had for the holidays. And now, like, you look in, and all of a sudden you've got four pieces of half-eaten cheese, or you've got this and that kind of cracker or whatever is left over. And do you just chuck them, or do you figure out a way to use it all and to do a pantry purge and yet not throw away cash down the compost heap? Plus, our own Maggie Early is here to help everyone who might try a dry January with some mocktails. Are you into that whole dry January thing?
Absolutely
like November,
not.
Do you grow a beard in November?
Yeah, I'm into November beards, but dry January, no. Never
it
have.
It seems to me January... It's when you need the, like, it's dark, it's dreary, it's cold, yeah. I need a little fortification. I don't know.
Yeah.
So, anyway, Maggie's here for you, for those of you who don't need it. I mean, need it. I mean, crave it. You have to have it. Our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge is back, brought to you by Rub With Love and our Rub With Love online shop. And, of course, let's chat about sauces first. And, Amy, I think you probably made up this segment because you might have some questions about sauces, being the home cook type. So what's your call? I mean, your note here says to rue or not to rue. And I always say don't rue the day that you don't rue.
Well, you know, what I would like to do in January, you know, eat healthier is always good, but I would never give up a cocktail. But this made me think of a segment you and Bridget did at an old Food Lovers weekend that we did at Hot Stove, where you did old mother sauces versus new mother sauces. Mm-hmm. And we read an article in the New York Times a few years ago that was the inspiration for this. And it was a lot of fun because Bridget demoed the old sauces.
That's her style. That's how she was trained, right?
Yes,
Bridget's been on the show many times, and she's an instructor here at the Hot Stove.
Mm-hmm.
And she's classically trained, both in school and in old kitchens throughout Europe.
Yeah. So she was doing a classic tomato, hollandaise, bechamel, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But this might tie in with the pantry. How can you lighten up those sauces and do an herb sauce or my favorite tahini sauce or pestos, anything like that? That's what made me think of it.
Well, I know this segment was thought about when Chef Terry is going to be here because he and I disagree a little bit about some of these sauces. And I wouldn't say that we... It's not really a disagreement. It's more of a style preference, right? Mm-hmm. So as long as I've known Chef Terry, he has made big, huge vats of veal stock and chicken stock and fish fumet and all these classic kind of stocks that he then takes and strains and clarifies and reduces down to these beautiful glacés, you know, these beautiful reduced drizzles on a plate or a puree of... yellow pepper or, you know, a dot of this or a dot of that.
Yeah.
That's just his style, and that's how he was trained. My style is very different, although in some areas somewhat simple. So when he takes a little yellow pepper, roast it, and then makes a puree, and then makes a dot on his plate, which is as much for design as it is for flavor, I think. Mm-hmm. I might do the same thing, but I'll do mine with plums and jalapenos and make a spicy plum sauce.
Yeah.
Right, so mine is just a little, he doesn't do spice the same way I do spice. But when it comes to the big mother sauces, I remember doing this demo with Chef Bridget, and we had a whole classroom of 40 people here, and people went around and tried each of our sauces. Like, for example, her bechamel, right? Well, it's a bechamel is butter, flour, roux, you cook your roux, you've got an onion studded with cloves, and you boil your milk, and then you put your, not boil it, but you scald your milk, and then you put the whole thing together. And she then took her sauce, put it in a roasting pan, and put it in the oven to bake.
Wow.
That is just, I mean, who does that?
Bridget.
Bridget does that. That's just the classic way to make bechamel. It's like, and so what I did, you know, so that took about an hour and 15 to an hour and 30 minutes for her. I just reduced a little cup of cream to a half cup of cream, and I had my cream sauce.
Yeah.
And so I did it mine in 5 minutes with herbs and, you know, lemon zest, and it was bright and delicious and the same. Are they the same sauce? No. And do they work in the same exact way? No. I could use her bechamel for my lasagna. I probably couldn't use my reduced cream. But if I'm making bechamel for like a manicotti or something where I have just like this cannelloni and I've got this kind of roasted cannelloni and I'm just going to drizzle it over top, I could do my cream sauce in a heartbeat over a oven-baked bechamel. So it's interesting to kind of think about when and where you might use the classic versus the new version of that.
And would you be willing, you know how I like to sneak vegetables in on our Torture Tom and Terry. Would you
Which
be
is
willing?
Funny because we both love vegetables.
Yes. But would you be willing to make like a cauliflower-inspired bechamel sauce?
Sure. I don't see why not. I'm not sure where I would use it, but you know, to me, honestly, if I'm making, let's say I'm going to put that on pasta, I just as soon do a roasted cauliflower with a little drizzle of fresh cream or something like that, mm-hmm. then make a big sauce out of the cauliflower. Mm-hmm. I love cauliflower. So it's not like you're trying to make mac and cheese and yeah. fool the kids, right, with some
yeah,
cauliflower
that's true.
In the mac and cheese. So classically, we had the same issue about marinara sauce. Mm-hmm. She wanted to reduce it down, cook it for hours. From canned tomatoes, cook it for hours. They're already cooked.
Yeah.
And to me, I did a 5 minute or less marinara where I just crushed the tomatoes, sauteed it in olive oil with a little bit of garlic and basil. I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
Literally a 5 minute sauce. Now, you have to admit, mine tasted fresher. It was yeah. not cooked to death. And that's just the difference between 50 years ago and today about how you approach that. And when we looked it up online, we always argue about this. And she looked it up and realized that what she was making was an old-fashioned tomato sauce, not a marinara. A marinara, by definition, is a fresh little tomato sauce, mm-hmm. five-minute sauce, right? It's just
sure.
boom, 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 done. So it's funny. We get caught up in these things, and I wouldn't ask her to change her style for the world. She loves it, and mm-hmm. and people love it, and people like my style, too. So it's more of just a preference of how you approach sauces in general. Terry, on the other hand, thinks my gravy is nuts, right? I love my sweet onion gravy. Uh-huh. It's a classic roux gravy. He would never roux a sauce like that. He would just as soon make a reduction of turkey jus and stuff like that and make a little jus instead of a gravy. So mine's old fashioned to him, right? And his is a more modern way without the flour. So just the way it is, the way it goes. Look who just showed up in the house. It's Miss Jackie Cross. She's going to step in here, play our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. When we come back on Cairo Radio, it's the Pantry Purge, 97.3 FM. And we're back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. I'm Tom Douglas, and stepping into Terry's chair for a few minutes here in this last hour is my wife, Jackie Cross, the farmer.
Oh, I could never step into Terry's shoes.
No way. But you could wear his hat if you wanted
maybe,
to.
Maybe. Maybe yeah, his hat.
Exactly. This is the Hot Stove Society Show. Jackie is my partner in all of our businesses, but also runs Prosser Farm, which you hear us talk about all the time here on the radio, growing vegetables. And last week when we chatted with her, she talked a bit about putting the farm to bed for the winter, all the things to go with that, but also you were diving headfirst into seed catalogs.
It's that time.
Anything
that
time. Anything coming up at this point?
So many. It's hard to decide. It's always, you go through about four different catalogs and look at about 27 different varieties of peas and then try and figure out which one it is that you want to grow.
And which one the sage rats aren't going to want to eat before we get to them.
All very yeah. silly, but
exactly.
fun.
Jackie, this segment, we're going to talk about the pantry purge. And, you know, when I was at the farm last week, I would open some drawers there at the farm, like our snack drawer. My goodness. You guys are crazy. There's like
snacks.
Seven bags of Cheeto jalapenos.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is not me. That is not me. I will just say that right now. That
okay.
is not my go-to. But there are some other people around there that seem to think those are the end-all, be-all.
So when I think about purging the pantry, I think about getting two things. One is, if it's bad, get rid of it. So I kind of taste through, and if things are stale or if things are rancid, like you have a rancid walnut oil or something, just throw it away, right? Get rid of it, move on. If things are stale, I pretty much say throw it away. But if you've got things that are still reasonably good, but you don't think you're going to get to before they get stale, and then what comes to my mind in our kitchen drawers at home is like we always bring in like the before Thanksgiving a variety of crackers, right? So there's the Kars water biscuits, there's the Beecher's cheese biscuits, there's all sorts of different kinds of crackers. But at this point, at the end of December, beginning of January, they're all open, but they're not likely to be used in the next month or so. So I would turn those. I would look at that, and I would say, what can I do with these rather than just throw them away? I would say, I'm going to make some delicious fine breadcrumbs, and I'm just going to put them in a little Ziploc or one of our storage containers, and I'm going to put them in the freezer. So next time I want to make Well, we're going to be grandparents in March, so when we need to make our chicken fingers for the grandchild,
yes.
I guess that's a ways away.
I don't think he'll be eating fish sticks for a little bit.
Anyway, so I put him in the freezer, and now I have breadcrumbs ready to go, and I don't have to use those Progresso ones that have been sitting in your drawer for in your cupboard for days. So that's one of the ones I would take on as just even if they're some rye crisps, some cheddar goldfish, whatever it is, just mix it all together, put them in your blender, and give it a quick, a quick grind, and then you've got breadcrumbs in your freezer. That's a good way.
Even if
you put potato chips in there, you know, you can put cornflakes in there. You know, just make a nice batch of breadcrumbs, and then you use up a bunch of little odds and ends.
Use them on top of your macaroni and cheese.
Speaking of that, your specialty is making mac and cheese out of the cheese drawer.
Right.
All the odds and ends cheeses. Well, how do you do that?
We always end up at the, especially around the holiday season where you've had maybe a few cheese plates or people have brought you their famous cheese balls or whatever, you end up with a pretty good assortment of cheese, and you can mix that all together and make very delicious macaroni and cheese.
Yeah, all you have to do is like on the brie type or camembert type, you just take the rind off and then you use that entire center as a melted, you know, melting cheese. You can use cream cheese. You can use fresh goat cheese in the fridge. Right. That is perfect.
Mix it with a little bit of cheddar. Mix it with like your leftover pizza mozzarella. Use it with some, you know, an end of your Parmesan that you've got left that you can grate up. All of that goes together and makes it very nice. Or you can also make grilled cheese sandwiches with that as well. It's delicious.
That combo grilled cheese sandwich, yeah. Bread. I know you always take our bread, the nice hearty. Kind of deck oven roasted breads that we buy and make. You always have a stash of cubes in the freezer, so because you are the bread
crouton queen.
Tell people how you make your croutons, because they are fabulous.
They are fabulous, but it is a little bit scary because they do take a really healthy dose of fat. So I use a little bit of bacon fat, and I use butter, and I use some olive oil, and I throw in a couple of garlic cloves and sort of brown those up a little bit, and then put in the bread cubes, let them soak around in that a little bit, and then just brown them and start tossing them around.
Just on low, right?
But it takes more fat than you think it's going to, so the reason they're delicious is because they're a little bit soaked in some delicious butter mixture.
Right, but you're not eating a pound of them.
No, you're not.
Yeah, so we had them on. I made a butternut squash soup the other night, and you had made your croutons for that. Which were awesome. But you're only eating maybe a dozen little cubes.
Yeah, a handful or something.
Yeah,
for sure.
So it makes it simple.
But if you've got the bread already cut up and in the freezer, it makes it super easy to do.
Getting back to oils, how do you tell if an oil or a nut is rancid? And you don't really have to eat them all. You should be able to smell if something.
Should be able to smell it.
Your body has a funny way of being able to say, something's not right here. Your olfactory areas.
For sure.
And so what is it, if I could put into words what a rancid smell is on, say, a hazelnut or on a cashew, it's the oily nuts really that come up rancid, like walnuts.
Well, you just don't get that sweet, nutty smell to them. You know, they just smell off.
It's hard to describe what that is, so that what that smell is, but it does smell off. And certainly if you taste it, if you have a rancid oil and you taste it and it tastes bitter and gross, it's really not unlike tasting a bad wine, right?
Sure.
We always say a bad wine tastes like wet dog. Like it's got a really kind of dewy, musty, nasty kind of flavor to it. So not that we've all licked wet dogs, but you can smell.
smelled wet dogs before.
Wet cardboard.
Wet cardboard, yeah, that kind of scenario. So those are definitely something to get moving on. How do you feel about expired cans of food? It's something we say when you're donating to the food bank annually. Don't just go through your pantry and give them every can of food. Check the expiration date on it first, because the food bank will not give out. They have to then, if you give that to them, they have to pay to throw it away. So how do you feel about expired cans of food, or your milk is a week old in the fridge? I still smell it.
If it's a dairy product, I still smell it. I mean, you can't really tell with a canned product until you open it.
Right. But you would open it.
I would open it, although, you know, what is an expired can of corn smell like? I don't know, you know.
Well, my guess is there's nothing wrong with it. They just have to put a Best Buy date on it.
Right.
And there's a big difference between expiration date
and Best Buy.
And a Best Buy date, right? A Best Buy date is just a suggestion. It's not necessarily bad or whatever, but on the milk, it'll smell sour.
Yeah, milk you'll know right off. And, I mean, I find that they last way longer than their expired date, especially something like buttermilk. I mean, you can have buttermilk a month past, and it's fine.
Old coffee beans. That's our last one on the list here of how to deal with old coffee beans. What do you say, Amy?
Well, would it be with if they had a nice oil or sheen to them? That would be my first guess, I guess.
Yeah. I say throw them away.
Throw them away. Throw them away.
You know, it's just tired. They're tired.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I would say bury them in the backyard. See if you get a coffee plant.
Yeah. And real quick, do you throw out all of your spices?
I tend to throw out the spices, but I have not been as diligent as I used to be on
it. Oh, you used to be very diligent.
Yes.
I remember
I used
you
to call
it
a New Year football, like a Super Bowl spice day, where
that
I get rid of all the spices.
That is not a fun Super Bowl party.
No. I get all the spices. I throw them away. I keep my jars. I take all my jars down to World Spice and have them sell me the minimum amount to refill them. Because there is nothing quite like having them at your fingertips when you want them.
Sure.
But when you go to your cabinet and you pull out a five-year-old spice and try to put it on a $25 a pound piece of salmon, not the best idea.
And you don't need to buy spices in such big quantities. It's better to buy them more frequently in smaller amounts.
Mm-hmm. I can't think of the name of the brand, but it comes in a little cardboard box they sell at the grocery store now. It's a much smaller amount. You don't save any money, right, because it's expensive to do that, but it is the right size to purchase those spices in.
But that might be something worth spending the money on.
Yeah. Like our spice rubs have an 18-month shelf life.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like anything, they start to degrade, right? So
it's
just simple as that. Up next, Maggie Early is here. She is one of the grand dames of our company and is also in charge of Maggie's Hooch Hut out at the Ballard Warehouse.
She is our favorite location at the warehouse.
We always meet at Maggie's Hooch Hut.
We frequent it.
Exactly. I want her to open one of our restaurants as Maggie's Hooch Hut.
I know.
Anyways, Maggie's going to take us down the path of mocktails in case you're having a dry January. On Cairo Radio, this is the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. And we're back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio. Tom Douglas here. Terry's got the day off. I've been joined by my wife, Jackie Cross.
Hello, everyone.
Who's jumped onto the Terry microphone. Amy, our producer, is here. And Maggie is stepping up to the mic. And Maggie Early, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
You said
you've
never been on the radio before. Here you are. This could be it for you.
I thought about putting on lipstick.
This is a debutante. Maggie, we have all enjoyed Maggie's Hooch Hut out at the Seattle Sirius Takeout at Ballard, our restaurant out there, which is at 52nd and 14th Northwest. Come by the dock sometime. I'm always doing pop-ups, or we got Sirius Takeout out there, or Dinner Box Series. But your job, one of your many jobs, is to create our cocktail program. And I've been watching you for months now make batches of this and that, and then put them in little plastic containers, which I find hilarious, and put labels on them and send them out into the world.
Yeah, it's very enjoyable for me because we've had so many open bottles of different booze and fruit and spices coming through from the restaurants. I've been able to be super creative and make random tinctures and random shrubs, which shrubs are my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
It goes well with the dry January.
Right.
And then people getting to try random cocktails that they may never have been able to try because we have such a wide variety of booze.
Or even thought of. People forget when we closed down in March, I had literally, between the theaters and the restaurants, 30 bars open. And so every bar has open booze, right? And so we had to figure out how to handle all that open booze from 30 bars.
Yeah.
And you have been on it since then.
We are almost through it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's been fun. But I am a drinker, for sure. Mm-hmm. I enjoy getting home from work and having a cocktail. It's very habitual for me. I feel like it transitions you into your next part of the day. Mm-hmm. And
totally agree.
you get to be in a new space. And I think that you can do the same thing with mocktails. I think that there's no reason why you can't make it special, have fancy ice cubes, fancy garnishes, make your own syrups and sauces and tinctures. And I think that a lot of people who fail at Dry January fail because they don't prepare for it.
Because it's not exciting enough?
Yeah, and they don't make it special. And
they open a ginger ale and think they're going to be satisfied.
Totally. And a ginger ale is delicious, but
once.
Not for 30 days.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, give us a few ideas, some recipes maybe, or a few thoughts.
Like I said, I love shrubs. I think a shrub is a delicious, easy way to make a drink that you can make in a large batch and have for a whole month.
Mm-hmm. Like what? How do you do it?
Yeah, so shrubs are equal parts fruit to vinegar to sugar. So one of my favorite ones right now with winter citrus is a grapefruit rosemary shrub. So you would take a cup of vinegar, a cup of sugar.
Any kind of vinegar? Just like
I like white wine vinegar. Okay. A lot of people like apple cider vinegar. I think the flavor.
So you get wine in there somehow.
Totally. Makes me feel good. I think apple cider vinegar is too strong of a flavor for a shrub. So a cup of sugar, a cup of vinegar, and a cup of fruit, whatever it is.
Do you cut that fruit up with the rind, or do you take a...
I would actually... So with a grapefruit, I would remove the rind and then peel as much of the pith off as possible so you get just the flesh. And then you would take the rind and the rosemary in a glass or a bowl and muddle it up a little bit so you release the oils of the rind and the herb. And then add a little bit of sugar and the fruit flesh, muddle it a little bit more. And then separately in a pot on your stovetop, you would take your cup of vinegar and the majority of your cup of sugar, stir it, dissolve the sugar, bring it to a quick boil, and then pour it over your fruit mix. Stir it, pop it in the fridge overnight in a covered container, and then the next day you would strain it, put it in a sealed jar of some sort, a mason jar, a Lexan, whatever it is, and have it for the whole month.
Delicious.
So you just take that, then now you've got this beautiful syrup in your fridge, you pour it over ice, put some club soda, and you're done?
Totally.
Oh, really?
I normally do about 2 ounces of a shrub to about 5 ounces of soda water. And I am a avid fan of the soda stream.
Are you?
Oh, my God. I take it on trips with me.
You do not.
I do.
Oh, she does. Oh, I have gone on trips with her.
And what's your reasoning? Just that it's less wasteful than
it's
a bottle?
It's so much less wasteful.
Yeah.
You don't have your plastic bottle of club soda or even a can. Mm-hmm. It takes up less space. It's very satisfying to pop that carbonation off.
And if you wanted to adjust that shrub, you could just change the mixer, right?
Absolutely.
Right.
You could do more shrub to less club soda.
You could use ginger beer instead of club soda. You can mix it all up.
You could add vodka or gin.
Exactly.
No. This is dry January. These are mocktails.
So if you make enough, you're preparing for February.
All right. Okay, so then next, what else besides a shrub?
I love bitters. Hmm? Bitters do have trace amounts of alcohol in them, but it's so minimal that I don't really worry about it when I'm not drinking. I think Scrappies makes lovely bitters. It's not hard to make your own bitters at home, and it's a pretty rewarding experience.
Here's my problem with Scrappies. There's a lot of scrap in Scrappies bitters. I don't know if you've read the ingredient list, but there's a lot of dyes.
Mm-hmm.
You're not using very much of it, so it doesn't.
It's drops of it.
Yeah.
And there are a ton of bitter companies out there.
Yeah.
Lots of local ones, international ones. You can find, I'm sure, a clean bitter. Clean bitter, yeah. But I love... Again, soda water with the soda stream, and then a couple dashes of cardamom and rhubarb shrub. I think it's a delicious drink. Super easy.
So what do you... Cardamom, you start to think chai and things like that, yeah.
Yeah, so it feels wintry.
I've become a real fan of chai tea for some reason.
Bengal delicious. Spice, man.
That's Celestial Seasonings Bengal Spice. I love that stuff.
Yeah.
That's the best one of all the chai teas that I've had.
Hands down.
Yeah.
It's so sweet, and there's no sugar in it. I don't even...
It's the licorice root.
Is it?
Yeah.
Ah, I thought it was the cinnamon.
I think it's the licorice root.
It's so good. And it's really good iced. If you take, like, 6 bags of it in a gallon container, it makes a beautiful iced tea. And that, too, you can keep in your refrigerator for the month and have a tasty beverage whenever you need it.
Exactly. Mix it with almond milk or oat milk or whatever kind.
Yeah.
Or no milk.
Yeah. Just with ice. It's great. I think that if you like sweet beverages, it's nice to keep different simple syrups on hand. And simple syrups are so easy to make. Like last week I took my leftover coffee grinds and poured it in a pot with some sugar and water, equal parts sugar to water, and just let it simmer for a minute and then pulled it off and strained it the next day. And I have a beautiful coffee simple syrup.
Wow.
And you can add that to, again.
And you had already used them to make coffee once?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's a little bit of recycling.
Yeah, awesome.
And yeah. That, you can add it to your coffee in the morning. You can do like a Brazilian-style carbonated coffee drink. Mm-hmm. You take that, soda water, ice,
the original
and
frappe.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And herbs this time of year, if you do like a thyme, simple, rosemary simple, really you can use whatever you want.
Yeah, exactly.
This summer I made a rose petal simple.
Oh, yum.
Simple syrup, right?
Simple syrup and stuff. It was delicious. So fun.
And just, did you use just rose petals or rose
hips? Rose petals. And you know, sugar, same thing, mm-hmm. and stuff, and just let it steep. It just had such a beautiful perfume. It was really pretty.
That sounds amazing. Mm-hmm. I love anything rose.
Do you?
I do. I'm such
I love
an old
pickled
lady.
Rose blossoms. That's my...
I think rose
they're
perfume
so pretty.
is the best. Yeah.
So mocktails don't have to be alcoholic. They're not at all alcoholic.
They're not at all.
So we have shrubs. We have about 1 minute. Any other ones that you don't want people to miss out on?
I think that the most basic mocktail that's also a good health tincture is just an ounce of apple cider vinegar and hot water in the morning is delicious. Or you can have it in the evening before you go to bed instead of your Manhattan or Negroni or whatever it is.
Yeah, I'm crying. I'm crying right now.
What about a nice, beautiful, fancy garnish?
It's so nice. If you take an apple and just peel it and fan it out, get a cute metal pick, toss it on top of your drink.
Uh-huh.
This makes you feel like...
You feel super fancy.
You feel so fancy and like it's a special occasion. Mm-hmm. When really it's a Tuesday night.
What about a cornichon and a beef jerky stick?
Delicious.
For your mock Bloody Mary. Mm.
I would have beef jerky with anything, so I am on board.
Bloody Marys have gotten crazy, haven't they?
With all the burger and the slice of pizza on top of it. It's crazy.
That's nuts.
If you want to join up on the January, the Dry January Parade, I'm not sure how many people are out there that are doing it in the middle of COVID and the freezing weather and all of that. But if you are, just check out Maggie's work there at the Maggie's Hooch Hut out at Sirius Takeout. We have our mocktails out there, too, and at the Sirius Pie downtown. Is that right?
I'll be adding some nice mocktails for January.
All right. Good. Check them out. When we come back, it's time. Maggie, you're going to stay for a little trivia.
Yep.
Jackie, you're going to do a little trivia.
Of course.
I think I'm going to get crushed today. We're going to do tasty trivia, food for thought, on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. And we're back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio. I'm Tom Douglas, and we're finishing up our second hour here with Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. I'm joined by Ms. Jackie Cross, Farmer-in-Chief.
Hello.
Prosser Farm, and Maggie Early of Maggie's Hooch Hut out at Sirius Takeout in Ballard.
Hello.
Welcome to Trivia, your first trivia show.
Thank you.
If you listen to the rules from Ms. Richardson, you'll know how this game is played.
Right.
First, I have to say this, though. This tasty trivia is brought to you by Rub With Love, handcrafted, versatile rubs, sauces, and mustards that add a flavorful kick and a whole lot of love to just about any meat, fish, or vegetable. And they're made by us right there at the Sirius Takeout in Ballard. Visit our Rub With Love carts at Seatown Market or Sirius Takeout in Ballard, or order online at TomDouglas.com, or go to Bartels, or go to Amazon, or go to Costco, or go to all the different grocery stores in town. You can find our stuff everywhere.
Okay, Maggie, I'm going to ask each one of you five different questions, and we are playing for listener Diane Craig of Lake Bay, Washington. She commented on our holiday edition of Kitchen Conundrums, and we're gonna give her a five-pack of Rub With Love. The loser of the trivia is going to have to pay for shipping. And in your pack, you have the toasted shallot mustard, pork rub peri-peri. My absolute favorite is the exotic mushroom rub and the veggie rub. So, Diane, we're playing for you. And, Jackie, we're going to start with you today.
Uh-oh, pressure's on.
All right. So these questions, since we talked about sauces and spices and cocktails, we are going to be talking about all of those today. All right, Jackie.
Okay.
What is the main difference between a Tom Collins and a John Collins?
No idea.
Okay. The John Collins has bourbon instead of gin.
Oh, interesting. I've never even heard of a John Collins.
I've never heard of it either.
Ooh. Okay. What is the name of the cocktail made with gin, vodka, white lillet, bitters, and a lemon zest that James Bond invents in Casino Royale?
Is that the Vesper?
Correct.
Wow. Woo-woo. Amy, I'm very surprised you got one right.
True or false, Nebbiolo is considered the noble grape of Tuscany, Italy.
True.
False, it is the noble grape of Piedmont.
Oh, yeah. Duh. Sorry.
That was a trick.
Your husband collects it. I don't know if you remember that or not.
That was silly.
This spice is the ground outer covering of the nutmeg seed.
Mace?
Correct.
Very good.
Okay, multiple choice. This sauce was created at the Delmonico restaurant in New York City. It contains butter, cream, egg yolks, sherry, and seasonings. Is it A, remoulade, B, velout, C, coulis, or D, Newburgh?
And what was it created for?
The Delmonico restaurant in New York City.
So it wasn't a steak sauce necessarily. It was for Delmonico.
Velout, I'm going to go with.
Incorrect. It was a Newburgh sauce.
Lobster Newburgh.
All right, Jackie, you have 2 out of 5.
Okay.
You might be paying for shipping today there,
you might
baby.
Be. I'm so sorry. Okay, Maggie, you're up next.
All right.
You know, Madeline was never sorry when she crushed us. With her questions.
Sounds about right.
You're much nicer than she is.
That's what everyone says.
Yes, exactly.
It's true.
Okay, Maggie, multiple choice. In the hit series Cheers, Sam utters the last line of the show's series finale. What does he say? A, good night, everyone. B, see you tomorrow, Woody. C, sorry, we're closed. Or D, Norm.
You're sorry,
right.
We're closed.
Nice guess.
It feels too real right now.
Yeah. Okay, in Brandy's, what does VSOP stand for?
Very special old person.
So close. It is very special old pale.
Oh, so close.
I wouldn't have known that either. I would give her half a point for
half
that.
Half a point. Okay. Yeah. We will.
You got 3 out of 4 letters.
True or false? Merlots from Washington State are likely to have a fruitier style than Merlots from California.
False.
You are correct. False. Washington Merlots are likely to be balanced with crisp acidity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This spice used in Jamaican jerk cooking, its taste and aroma remind many people of a mix of cloves, cinnamon, and nutmeg.
Allspice?
Woo! Correct!
Not paying for shipping!
Okay, last question. Multiple choice. Though it literally translates into seafood, this sauce actually contains no fish. Ingredients include soybeans, white vinegar, water, rice, salt, flour, red chilies, garlic, and often sweet potatoes. Is it A, teriyaki, B, hoisin, C, soy sauce, or D, shiso?
Shiso.
Not correct. It is hoisin.
Oh, yeah. Man.
So you did 3.5 out of 5.
Very nice job for your first effort here at the Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge.
All right, Tommy D. Number one, what did Brian Flanagan name his bar in the 1988 film Cocktail starring Tom Cruise?
I have to Google that. Hold on 1 second. The Dead Rabbit.
Oh, no. Cocktails and Dreams.
Oh, my God.
I love that question.
Good name.
Is that the one where he flips all the cocktail shakers around?
Yeah, it's all about like flair bartending.
Yeah.
Okay, which key ingredient is missing for a Long Island iced tea? Gin, vodka, white rum, Cointreau, lemon juice, dash of cola, and a lemon wedge. What ingredient is missing?
Tea.
No.
I haven't a clue.
Tequila.
Oh, tequila.
We know that you have drank those before.
Yeah, those are my favorite.
I can see that.
All right. So far, zero.
Thank you for that. Thanks for the update.
Keep it going. Keep it going.
True or false, Pinot Gris is a gray mutant of the black Pinot Noir grape.
Absolutely true.
You are correct.
Yeah.
Okay, often confused with oregano, this herb is sometimes called
marijuana.
Wild oregano.
That's wild. This herb, marjoram.
Correct. Okay, last question. After sautéing some meat in a pan, there are brown bits left on the bottom of my pan. What are the brown bits called? A, scrappables, B, fond, C, scum, or D, burntings?
I'm going to go with fond.
You are correct.
Yeah. Although I've never heard of any of those before.
Well, scum is a cooking term that when you're making
your stock. Yeah,
correct.
Exactly.
Yep.
Well, that was very exciting, Amy, for your first trivia.
Oh, thanks.
Nice job.
Thank you.
If
and
you
I'm
wanna...
so sorry, Jackie. You are paying for shipping.
All right, all right.
And who's our winner again?
Maggie is our winner with 3.5 out of 5 questions.
All right. Way to go, Mags.
Clear brain from the mocktails.
That's right. If you want to be part of the show, you can join the community on Facebook at Hot Stove Society Radio Show. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. This show is produced by our team, Madeline Pennington and Amy Richardson, although this is Amy's taking over solo for now. Our sound and production is by Sean McFadden, and our editor is Sean Don't Call Me Del Torre. Also remember, if you miss any episode of a Hot Stove Society show on Cairo 97.3, you can listen via podcast. Just subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app. Thanks for listening.